It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Next, how Democratic candidate Joe Biden is responding to the president's attempts to link him to corruption in Ukraine.
This is not about me and my family. There's not one single solitary legitimate journalist in the world that's given any credibility to this.
Also debunking a conspiracy theory from the Ukraine call. Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. In Dallas, Texas, tensions were high and security was ramped up around the courthouse where a former police officer is standing trial for murder in the shooting of her neighbor. Amber Geiger, who's white, wept in court as she took the stand today, describing how she says she mistakenly entered the wrong apartment and then thought Botham Jean, who was black, was an intruder. Geiger's defense team believes her actions were justified because she thought she was inside her own apartment. Here she describes the moments just before the shooting.
I have my gun pointed, and I'm saying, let me see your hands, let me see your hands.
What were you focused on?
Him.
Just him?
Yes.
Authorities say intense media attention and controversy surrounding Jean's death have led to threats that prompted additional private security for Geiger and her attorneys. The case has also fueled anger over the mounting death toll of unarmed black men. A group of environmental organizations is suing the Trump administration for its decision to revoke California's ability to set its own tailpipe emission standards. As NPR's Nathan Rott tells us, 23 other states filed a similar suit last week.
The Trump administration's decision to end California's auto emissions waiver under the Clean Air Act broke nearly 50 years of precedent. And, like most of the administration's many, many regulatory rollbacks, the move drew quick criticism and promised lawsuits. This lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Transportation by the Environmental Defense Fund, Sierra Club, and other environmental organizations asserts that the administration's move is arbitrary and capricious, contrary to the law, and unwarranted by facts. Nearly two dozen states are making similar claims. The challenges could make their way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
Stocks finished the week lower across the board on Wall Street today. The Dow lost 70 points. NASDAQ dropped 91. You are listening to NPR News. The next Spider-Man movie will continue to be a partnership between Disney's Marvel Studios and Sony. As NPR's Andrew Limbong tells us, the news is coming after a long back-and-forth negotiation over the future of the beloved character.
Spider-Man has spent the summer at the center of negotiations between Sony, which owns the rights to the character, and Disney, which has been licensing those rights.
Hey guys, the illegal weapons deal fair was at 10:30.
At issue was how much of a share Disney would get for the next Spider-Man movie, whether Marvel Cinematic Universe producer Kevin Feige would be on board, and any further Spider-Man appearances in other Marvel movies. A joint statement from both companies says they'll work together to make the third Tom Holland Spider-Man movie to be released in 2021. But Feige, who will be producing, hinted at a Spider-Man future separate from Disney, saying, quote, as Sony continues to develop their own Spideyverse, you never know what surprises the future might hold. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
The government says consumers boosted their spending by just 0.1% in August, the smallest gain in 6 months, even as incomes rose at a solid pace. The Commerce Department says inflation was flat overall. Consumers are a critical driver of the economy, accounting for about 70% of U.S. economic growth. Most economists say the reluctance to spend stems from uncertainty surrounding the U.S.-China trade war. Stocks finished the week lower on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 70 points, NASDAQ 91. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from T. Rowe Price, offering a strategic investing approach that examines investment opportunities firsthand. Institutions, advisors, employers, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence. And from Progressive Insurance, comparing car insurance rates from multiple insurers so shoppers can evaluate options in one place. Now that's Progressive. Comparisons available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Former Vice President Joe Biden is in Las Vegas today for a town hall. It's the first full-scale campaign event he's held since Democrats moved forward with an impeachment inquiry into President Trump. And of course, Biden is a key figure in that story. He's a potential rival to the president in the 2020 election and apparently enough of a threat to Trump that the president repeatedly asked Ukraine's leader to investigate Biden and his son. NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow is with Biden in Nevada, and he's on the line now. Hi, Scott.
Hey, good afternoon.
How is Biden responding to all of this?
Notably, he's been pretty restrained and on message. He hasn't held many events this week. It's mostly been fundraising. He had that brief four-minute statement early in the week responding to all of this, and he was on Jimmy Kimmel Live on ABC earlier this week. Biden has mostly been criticizing Trump for an abuse of presidential power. And when it comes to defending himself, he's sticking to a very short, direct statements like what he said here on the show.
This is not about me and my family. There's not one single solitary legitimate journalist in the world that's given any credibility to this. They've debunked all of what he's had to say for the past, since Giuliani started this a while ago.
And that is true. All reporting on the shows that Biden's pressure to Ukraine to fire the prosecutor was in line with U.S. foreign policy, with what many European Union countries wanted to see. And there is no evidence there was any investigation into the Ukrainian gas company his son Hunter was on the board of.
So the facts here are pretty clear. There is no evidence that Biden did anything improper. And yet President Trump still keeps associating Biden with possible corruption. Is there any sense of whether that could hurt or maybe even help Biden?
And to that end, the Trump campaign just announced an $8 million ad buy with this message, which, again, like we said, is just not backed by the facts. I talked to a lot of Democrats about this week, and there's some split thinking. Some worry that a drumbeat of attacks could be a drag and that the broader conversations about Hunter Biden taking positions like that when his father was the vice president could remind some Democrats about all of the influence stories that hurt Hillary Clinton in 2016. Biden did acknowledge early in this campaign that he knows that Republicans and political opponents would attack him for Hunter Biden. But more Democrats are also saying that this could maybe help Biden. It shows that Trump thinks he's the biggest threat. And we know that voters, Democratic voters, are so focused on electability that idea that Trump's most worried about Biden could really actually help him.
How is the rest of the Democratic field responding?
Very, very warily. They're obviously mostly focusing on President Trump. They're supporting the House Democratic impeachment inquiry. No one is taking the allegation about firing the prosecutor seriously. But when it comes to the broader influence questions, there are hesitant, careful responses. And that's best summed up by Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren in New Hampshire this week. She was asked by a reporter if she would allow a family member of her vice president to serve on a foreign board like Hunter Biden did. Here's what she said.
No.
I don't know.
I mean, I'd have to go back and look at the details.
Do you think there could be a problem?
I have to go back and look.
And that's really indicative of a way a lot of the other Democratic candidates have been answering these questions this week, pretty carefully, not wanting to take any direct attacks.
So one of the big revelations this week is suddenly the primary campaign is not the most important political story in America.
I'm trying not to take it personally.
Well, I mean, how is that likely to affect the race as a whole?
You know, there's broad agreement on this point. This essentially freezes the race in place right now. The focus is on D.C., not Iowa and New Hampshire. I think that could actually hurt Warren in the short term. There were a lot of polls that came out this week showing her ahead of Biden nationally and in key states. Normally, that would come with a ton of coverage about her maybe being the front runner now. She just hasn't gotten that press attention because of everything else that's happening.
That is NPR's Scott Detrow with former Vice President Biden in Las Vegas. Thank you.
Sure thing.
There's a revealing section of President Trump's July phone call with the president of Ukraine. It shows just how much Trump is still thinking about the 2016 election. He mentions the cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike. Here's how it reads in the memo from the call. Quote, "I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike." There are ellipses here. "I guess you have one of your wealthy people, the server, They say Ukraine has it. Well, to decode what the president is saying, we turn to Ryan Broderick. He's a senior reporter at BuzzFeed. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
So CrowdStrike is an American cybersecurity firm. Their name first came up in the news back in 2016 during the election. Why?
They were the firm brought in by the DNC to investigate the hack that took place in 2016. And they're most known for being the firm that debunked the initial idea that it was conducted by a lone hacker. They were the people who basically said this was done by two groups of Russian-backed hacking outlets.
So they introduced the idea of it being a cyber attack, basically, from
exactly.
another country, foreign intervention, rather than a random lone wolf.
Yes, they're sort of the ones that started the whole idea of collusion with Russia.
Now, how does Ukraine come in?
Very confusing, but let's see what I can do here. So on the internet, things move really fast. It's like a huge game of telephone. So once this firm caught the attention of the far right online, they discovered that it was owned by a Russian-American man who had previously done some work for a think tank called the Atlantic Council. It's a DC-based think tank, sort of works alongside NATO, and it's a pretty innocuous place. It does research on misinformation and digital warfare, things like that. And there's a Ukrainian oligarch who is on one of the advisory boards for the Atlantic Council. And it seems somewhere along the line, the Ukrainian oligarch became the owner of CrowdStrike. This is not true, of course, but when things are moving so fast online, facts start to combine together and it becomes very confusing.
So the idea is people who are on the far right, conspiracy theorists, went looking for a connection, went looking to say, who are these CrowdStrike guys? And once they do enough looking, they're able to find a Ukrainian oligarch who they say, aha. This
right.
is the connection. So what about this server that the president implied was somehow in Ukraine? I mean, he, on this call, talked to Ukraine's leader and brought up CrowdStrike. What would he be looking for?
It's a common misconception that there's some sort of missing server from the DNC hack it. But it's not true. The hack involved 140 cloud-based servers, and they were all decommissioned in 2016. There was no single server that was, you know, stolen in the dead of night and smuggled to the Ukraine or something. This was based on a fundamental misunderstanding of both the technology involved and the firm involved. And trying to make sense of it is almost impossible because it's not really a logical idea.
What's remarkable about the president referring to the DNC hack of 2016 in a 2019 call to a foreign leader?
I think it just goes to show you how much he, like the rest of us, is stuck in this social media feedback loop that started with that election.
What do you mean by that?
The 2016 election was a huge moment in America. It created so much discussion and viral content at once that we're all still analyzing and arguing and debating about what happened. And I think what this call proves is that President Trump is in that feedback loop as well.
You reached out to CrowdStrike. They said, look, we have nothing to do with this. But can I ask, in Ukraine, would Ukraine's president know what President Trump was talking about?
I have to wonder what the Ukrainian president was thinking when he heard it.
That's Ryan Broderick. He's a senior reporter at BuzzFeed. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Absolutely.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Justice Department is cracking down on fraudulent genetic cancer testing. It's charged 35 people who are associated with dozens of telemedicine companies and cancer genetic testing labs. NPR's Patty Naiman reports.
The federal investigation, called Operation Double Helix, targeted alleged schemes involving the payment of illegal kickbacks and bribes, which cost the Medicare program more than $2 billion in unnecessary charges. Joe Beemsterboer with the Department of Justice.
The elderly or disabled are being preyed upon. Elderly are being asked at a call center, would you want to know if you have cancer? Then the system can move very fast when you can reach out to hundreds and hundreds and thousands of patients very quickly with modern technology.
Shimon Richman with the Department of Health and Human Services describes how it worked. Telemarketing companies trolled Medicare beneficiaries online or called them on the phone or even sent people to approach them face to face.
To health fairs, to senior centers, to low-income housing, to religious institutions like churches and synagogues.
Where they offered seniors genetic testing for cancer risk or how well certain drugs would work for them at no cost. All they had to do was provide their Medicare information, a copy of their driver's license, and a cheek swab to obtain their DNA. And the sales pitch, says Richman, included lots of aggressive scare tactics.
Essentially telling patients that if you don't have this test, you could suffer from a variety of conditions or you could die, you know, and by the time you found out that you have something that needs to be treated, it's too late.
Once recruiters got the information they wanted, they tried to get the patient's actual doctor or healthcare provider to write a prescription for the test. If that didn't work, they asked a doctor who agreed to write prescriptions for patients they didn't know.
And these doctors, in many cases, have zero contact with the patient, have no knowledge of their healthcare situation or needs.
But there was money to be made from Medicare reimbursement for the genetic test. Typically, lots of money split between the patient recruiter, the doctor writing the prescription, the lab that did the test, and the telemarketing company that organized the alleged scheme.
Anywhere from 10 to 18 and even sometimes over more than $20,000 being billed to Medicare.
Adding up to a total, as of now, of $2.1 billion in taxpayer losses in what Beamster Board describes as one of the largest and complex healthcare fraud schemes ever.
From those collecting patient information, to those selling it, to those through doctors corruptly prescribing these tests, all the way through the labs then corruptly billing the Medicare program.
HHS official Richman says the labs often didn't even send results to patients. And when they did, there was no counseling or help interpreting the findings.
So patients left with a report that's meaningless to them and is certainly not providing them any benefit in terms of their health care.
And Richman says the testing could actually backfire. If in the future, for example, the patient's doctor determines the patient needs the genetic test, Medicare likely won't pay, citing an earlier payment. The tests are expensive, which would probably put them out of reach for many patients to pay out of pocket. If convicted, defendants could face decades in prison. Patty Namond, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
You're listening to Morehead State Public Radio 90.3 FM. Chaz Jenkins here with you. Support for MSPR comes from MSU Athletics, online at msueagles.com. Soccer will host Belmont tonight at 6 p.m. and Purdue Fort Wayne at 2 p.m. on Sunday. Volleyball also welcomes Belmont at 6 p.m. tonight and Tennessee State at 2 p.m. tomorrow. Tickets and more information from the Eagle Athletic Office at 783-2089 or online at msueagles.com. Celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Woodstock Music and Arts Festival with a Woodstock tribute at the Morehead Conference Center at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, October 29th. The MSU Music Industry Club performs songs by Jimi Hendrix, The Who, Grateful Dead, Santana, and more. All ages are welcome. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. Tickets are $7 and free to MSU students. Time is 4:49.
Do you know about Morehead State University Career Services? We partner with students, faculty, staff, and employers for the purpose of preparing MSU students for the global workforce. If you are looking for a full-time employee or student intern, we will work to connect you with qualified candidates. Attend our career fair on October 1st to find employees or career opportunities. All of our programs are open to the community. Find out much more by calling 606-783-2233 or visiting moreheadstate.edu/career.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Republicans on Capitol Hill are, for the most part, defending President Trump and criticizing Democrats for opening an impeachment inquiry. Conservative media outlets have been cheering them on, saying Trump did not do anything wrong in his call with the Ukrainian president. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has been following the story. He joins us now from New York. Welcome back, David.
Hey, Audie.
Tell us how conservative media figures have covered this story as new information comes to light in the impeachment inquiry.
Well, let's acknowledge we're talking about this because in some ways this is one of the most important parts of the president's base, is not only his megaphone echo chamber where he works out ideas, but really a part of the base itself. And none more important than Fox News. By and large, I want to stress by and large, he's had strong support both in terms of attacking the Democrats and in terms of defending the president. Let's start last night. Tucker Carlson, primetime host, really going after the Democrats who have kicked off this impeachment inquiry.
In other words, the same people who spent 2 years writing Russia collusion fan fiction are outraged once again. Or did they ever stop being outraged? Probably not.
A number of other folks, personalities on the air going after the whistleblower, Geraldo Rivera, sometimes a critic of the president on immigration, sometimes a supporter. Geraldo said, you know, this guy is a snitch, a fink, you know, I'd like to find him, and basically said he wanted to beat him up. Jeanine Pirro, who has her own weekend show, is often an analyst on the weekday shows. Here's what she had to say earlier today.
This whistleblower, whoever he is, if he's the CIA guy or whatever it is, it doesn't matter. This was a setup. Who were these other people in the White House who were looking to sink our president?
Very much echoing there, as many of her colleagues have, the president's own rhetoric questioning loyalty of the person making these accusations.
And yet for people who are close watchers of the network, there's a sense that there's been some tension. Can you tell us why people have that perception?
Sometimes there's been a tension at Fox between the folks who are reporting, the folks who are doing the opinions. Now you're seeing some real tensions on both sides of that equation. You saw Shep Smith hosting analysis from Judge Andrew Napolitano, an analyst for the network that basically calls into question the president, saying the president may in some ways have legal exposure here. And he was attacked on Tucker Carlson's show, both by Carlson and Joe DiGiovanna, a former federal prosecutor. And you also had an exchange like this between news anchor Sandra Smith and Chris Wallace earlier today.
The complaint alleges a quid pro quo, the exchange of something for value. And the actual phone conversation revealed...
You don't think that dirt on Joe Biden and Joe Biden's son would be of value to... You asked a question. Let me answer it, Sandra.
Now, Sandra Smith did let him answer it. At the same time, she, like a number of other folks, were stressing questions that people helping the White House, allied to the White House, wanted to make.
Beyond Fox, how is this playing?
You're seeing a lot of conservative voices rally to the president's side, but there are some distinctions. At the National Review, you see some questioning, some voices saying, you know, perhaps impeachment may not be wise, but the president may have done some things wrong here. You're seeing more critical voices some ways in some of the smaller conservative outlets, certainly than you are on Capitol Hill, but than you are particularly on place like Fox as well.
In the meantime, David, I want to talk about another topic. The New York Times published a piece that gives a fair amount of detail about the identity of the whistleblower. The attorneys for the whistleblower released a statement saying that it compromises person's security or could turn unwanted glare on their colleagues. I remember seeing some cancel the Times, you know, hashtag on social media. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, there are a number of people on the political left, the critics of the president, a number of people within journalism who said, you know, what the Times have done in some ways is reckless here. They protect the anonymity of sources. Why would they do this to a whistleblower whose protection of identity should be guaranteed by statute as well as in principle? You know, what Dean Baquet has said, the executive editor of the Times, is, you know, we're trying to provide the American public with enough information so they can evaluate the credibility of the person who's making such important and serious, profound accusations and allegations against the president. And I've got to say, as an impulse, I think that's probably the right journalistic impulse. But the question is, once you have the information, what you do with it, how you cast it, whether you publish. And I think that very question and decision is being questioned right now.
That analysis from NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, speaking to us from New York. David, thank you.
You bet.
When Steven Soderbergh isn't making blockbuster comedies like Ocean's 11, he's often directing movies designed to stoke outrage. In Aaron Brockovich, outrage about poisoned drinking water. In The Informant, about price fixing. And now, in The Laundromat, critic Bob Mondello says about money laundering.
When we meet them, lawyers Ramon and Jürgen are in the middle of a desert so far from civilization there are cavemen around. This is the director's way of noting their schemes are as old as time. They, however, are modern with a vengeance, the sort of guys you'd find at the baccarat tables in an Ocean's movie, attired in tuxes, swilling cocktails, played by Antonio Banderas and Gary Oldman, and telling stories, all of which
are about money. The idea of money, the necessity of money. The secret life of money.
They begin with the barter system appropriate to those cavemen and then progress to more complicated schemes designed to separate the average person
someone to win
from his or her cash.
Someone has to lose.
Schemes involving offshore accounts and other legal but not entirely ethical means of hanging on to money. As they're explaining, we meet a lady affected by those schemes, Ellen, played by Meryl Streep, who watches her husband die in a boating accident, gets through the funeral, and then goes to her lawyer.
Shoreline cruises, like most of these outfits, they have insurance for accidents and such.
So basically, they drown Joe and 20 other innocent people, and you can get insurance for that.
Yeah, you can. But as she and the cruise company discover, that doesn't necessarily mean you're insured. When her payout is tiny, Ellen uses it to go try to find the insurance company, and what she finds instead...
It's a law firm. In Panama.
She's in a newspaper office trying to get a reporter to cover the scam she's uncovered.
And our readers need to know about them. Why? What they do is they set up companies. Not real companies like a hotel or a hardware store. They set up what they call a shell, and they sell shells. Not actual shells. I'm sorry you lost me.
The world's most clueless reporter, but in fairness, money laundering is complicated, as we all discovered when the Panama Papers were leaked in 2016. Millions of documents that led down a rabbit hole of chicanery devised by Mossack and Fonseca, the real-life masterminds that Oldman and Banderas are playing, schemes that headquartered a quarter of a million corporations in one small town in Delaware, with one woman listed as the CEO of 25,000 of them, and on and on.
They're getting away with murder.
Which is bad.
Bad? Yeah, bad is such a big word for being such a small word.
The Laundromat is a satirical explainer, not a movie that's driven by plot. It's designed to amuse and to infuriate and, in its final moments, to inspire with words taken directly from the leaker of the Panama Papers, riveting, galvanizing words, some of which you will almost certainly not hear because director Soderbergh has a visual trick up his sleeve that will elicit dialogue-smothering gasps. He's a master, something you remember when The Laundromat is humming along deep in its spin cycle. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Conrad N. Hilton Foundation, awarding the $2 million Hilton Humanitarian Prize to a nonprofit organization. Information about prize recipients and nominations is at hiltonfoundation.org/prize. From EBSCO, leveraging the expertise behind CINAHL to provide tools that support nurses. With Dynamic Health, an evidence-based resource, nurses learn skills to further impact patient care. More at health.ebsco.com. And from Atlassian, a collaboration software company powering teams around the world. Committed to providing the tools and practices to help teams plan, track, build, and work better together. More at Atlassian.com.
Broadcasting from the campus of Morehead State University, you're listening to WNKY, Morehead, Kentucky. Support for Morehead State Public Radio comes from our listeners, underwriting partners, Morehead State University, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Tell your smart speaker to play Morehead State Public Radio. Time is 4:59 here on MSPR 90.3 FM.
Radio listeners tune to WMKY for local news and music that's intelligent, insightful, and entertaining. If you own or operate a business, WMKY can help reach your customers. Public radio listeners support businesses that advertise on public radio, placing dollars back into the community. Grow your business, reach your customers, and support public radio with underwriting on WMKY. Get started today. Call 783-2334. That's 783-2334.